The question asked here is this. Why does the Buddha, at least I think you were quoting the Buddha, speak of the vile body? If all life is an expression of the uncreated, unborn, why should the body, which is also our means to lead the holy life, be considered vile? It's a very good question. There are several aspects involved here. The psychophysical organism, which is called a human being, the body as such is of animal descent. It inherits some of the outstanding animal characteristics. Particularly the ones which become sources of conflict. The general characteristic of an animal to be in harmony, to live in harmony with the laws of his own being, are naturally observed by all animals. But in that observation, there is no option to say, no, I won't live according to the law of my being or the purpose of my existence. Unknowingly, naturally, they fulfill the law of their being. We talk about the tiger red in tooth and claw and the beast of prey and so forth, and we feel frightened and repelled and so forth. But let us not forget that perhaps the tiger's contribution is to keep the balance of nature. Maybe that is fulfilled. The tiger doesn't know any different. He cannot know. He hasn't got that physical structure which would enable our sort of psychological functioning to function in him. You see? So the tiger is like that. Now, we human beings are rather different. We have the capacity to look within ourselves and to recognize our self-consciously. And we start in terms of separative, isolative self-consciousness. The natural instincts of the whole animal kingdom to safeguard its own existence and to perpetuate the species is also in us. And associated with that is a degree of aggressiveness and self-centeredness and so forth. Those are our animal characteristics. We have been on the globe, I don't know how many years, some 3 or 4 million years, as man, this structure. And it has undergone an evolutionary process side by side with a developmental process in terms of mind. And we have become very, very different. But we have become very, very different in a somewhat lopsided manner. The brain has perhaps grown out of proportion to the other aspects of our life. Our moral side, our compassionate side, is not fully human. We started as tool makers, and we began to obtain control over our environment to an extent far greater than the control which an animal has over its environment. And with our self-consciousness and self-knowledge, qualities like aggressiveness engendered egoism, pride, the passion for domination, and so forth. You know how in the Bible it is said, and the Lord God gave man dominion over the other kingdoms of nature and so forth. But what does dominion really mean? Dominus, the Lord of the household, of the district, or whatever it is the protector in the first instance. He is the one who looks after them. Dominion is a paternal function. It is not domination. It is control over the external up to a certain point as necessary for the preservation of law and order in a society, in a family, in a home, and nurturing with understanding and love. He is the protector. In that sense, we talk of Lord as God, as Dominus, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. Now, as we developed our capacity to control the external circumstance, we also began to use our skill and the growth of our intellect, knowledge, memory, and so forth, to serve our particular desires. And our particular desires derive from the pleasurable, mainly from the pleasurable sensations which characterize our bodily existence. The body itself, the physical body by itself, leave the psyche alone for the time being, has an innate, ingrained pleasure-pain mechanism functioning. If this pleasure-pain mechanism didn't function satisfactorily, we would probably get wiped out pretty quickly. Because it is this mechanism which tells the body, be careful of that, don't do that, because it will hurt you to such an extent that the body will perish. Now, what happens to us as human beings? Our natural bodily pleasure-pain mechanism, we have been more or less able to take in our stride and go on. It is a pure mechanism, and that is how the body functions. All right, we take it for granted. But what did the psyche do? The psyche said, oh, this is very nice. I'd like more of it. And what did the body do with respect to a painful sensation? Oh, I don't like this. I want to get rid of this. And if I can't get rid of the source of the pain, I shall destroy it. You see what happened? Instead of this harmony of a pleasure-pain mechanism functioning for the healthy preservation of the organism, the psyche unbalanced us altogether. And so, attachment, greed, craving arose on the one hand, and aversion, hate, destructiveness arose on the other hand. Man's sense of transcendence began to emerge into consciousness after a long period of evolution. That, if I'm not mistaken, is one of the meanings of the Old Testament, starting off with Adam and God on speaking terms. Curious thing, isn't it? And you will find similar presentations in the other cultures too. Man starts off on speaking terms with the transcendent. But speaking terms which are free of the intrusion of conceptualizing and verbalizing. It was a natural state of communion, an unknowing communion. So one lived in harmony. But the moment this self-consciousness intervened, then we came down. This presentation of the tree of life in the Garden of Eden, in the middle of the garden, as well as the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, in the middle of the garden. You can't have two trees in the identical spot in the middle of the garden. And it was said, do not eat of this tree in the middle of the garden, for you will assuredly die. What is the fruit of the tree of life? It is the awakening and the consciousness, the clear consciousness of transcendence. That is the fruit of the tree of life. But if this person, the psychophysical organism, is unfit, because the psyche is in conflict and subject to all its wayward passions and desires, you see, if that is the case, then plucking that fruit puts me into a daze. And therefore, the sort of consciousness that develops in me is this discriminative consciousness, which is unable to discern truth, fact, reality, but chooses the pleasant against the unpleasant, chooses to satisfy its own ambitions, to dominate instead of exercising true dominion. And it becomes, it scars the tree of life and converts it into the tree of good and evil. Virtue in the supreme sense is in the shadow. Remember yesterday, was it? I mentioned desire from desiderare to look away from the light. Sidararis, from Sidus Sidaris, a star, which is a self-shining light. And a self-shining light always means the light from within, which casts no shadow. So now, the body has become the source of things evil. In our lives. Perhaps that is why the Buddha uses the phrase, this vile body. Then there's another aspect to it. The body is born, it grows, it decays, it dies, suffers from disease, it can spread disease by contagion and so on. So there is so much vileness about it. Now if a bhikkhu, if a man calls upon the enlightened one, the holy one, to come and see him personally, it means that a body is coming to see this dying body. The dying person, the dying body, imagines that it will benefit in a manner which fulfills the purpose of its existence. But this is an illusion. There is no fulfillment of the purpose of existence just if one body comes to another body. And the Buddha, knowing well that aspect of it, tells this monk, Vakkali was his name, some kind person in this group came and told me the name, I had forgotten it. Vakkali was the monk who was dying. The Buddha came and said, first, what is there to see in this vile body? And you know that whenever the monks called upon the Buddha to see them when they were approaching death because they were so very ill and they knew that they wouldn't survive very long, the Buddha went to them personally sometimes, and sometimes he sent Sariputta or Moggallana or someone like that. And what did they do when they came to that monk? After the first kindly, courteous inquiries, how are you? How are you getting on? And the poor monk would say, Lord, my pains are not ceasing, they are getting worse, etc., etc. Then, what sort of comfort did either the Buddha or the great disciples give? No comfort in our sense of the term. They asked the monk, is body permanent or impermanent? And the monk would say, impermanent. Is that which is impermanent the ill or the well? The true, in the true sense of the word, well. It is the ill, dukkha, suffering, far from the transcendent, far from the infinite. That's the meaning, if you derive the word dukkha, it comes from du, in the Sanskrit dukkha, comes from du, meaning bad or spoiled, and kha, meaning the infinite. Ungodly, if we may use an ordinary phrase. It is dukkha. Then the Buddha or the disciple would ask, are feelings, vedana, sensation, permanent or impermanent. And it would be repeated with all the constituents of the temporal psychophysical organism. And they were all impermanent. And the ending would be, therefore, with right wisdom, seeing that truth, put aside the ill. Now, what is not openly presented in the texts is this. We think that the Holy One went to the sick person and just gave him the usual moral, sensible advice. But have we ever experienced the influence of the Holy One's presence on us in full force? What happens? Do you think that a Buddha went and just said a few conventional words? Because the thing is repeated in every case. Just said a few conventional words, like somebody might say, "Oh my dear, I'm so sorry for you, and I do suffer with your suffering," all the rest of it. Those words are impotent. The feeling of compassion, etc., may be there, of course, and it may be a small comfort to somebody, true enough. But the presence of a Holy One, a truly Holy One, whose inner consciousness is completely liberated, brings to bear a spiritual energy, an archetypal energy, which enables the dying person to undergo the transformation in consciousness himself. That perhaps is what did happen in those cases. That perhaps underlies statements which we have in the Puranas and other scriptures of miracles and the transformation of the person to such an extent in his inner being that the whole residue of evil-mindedness, of ignorance and so on inside him is suddenly burnt up, and that person, that dying body in his consciousness is at one with transcendence. We need not rule out that possibility. I freely acknowledge that this is something which I am saying myself. It may not be so, I don't know. But I have a feeling that perhaps something like that did happen. So, not a case of giving comfort in the ordinary sense of the word, not a case of producing a medicine which would prolong his life, but this, which brought about the fruition of that being in his innermost nature and liberated him. Let us, in this connection and your statement from Shakespeare, "Ripeness is all," consider this question of death. What is death in actuality? Not merely as we are aware of birth and death. In order to understand that, let us consider existence itself. Not the totality of existence, but individual existence. You or I, or a tree, or an animal, or anything. This whole process of samsara, which is full of pain, as we say, and so forth. You see, the whole manifestation process is a changing process. The one unchanging fact is that everything changes. We use lovely phrases, the eternal hills and the eternal stars. They give a good impulse to us, a good sensation, healthy sensation, if you like, a happy sensation. But nothing manifested as a particular thing, cognizable as a particular thing, is unchanging. There is no such thing as a permanent entity. That is why I feel that the theistic presentation of God as a permanent entity is a self-contradictory definition. Entity means a thing, a particular something, just come into being, proceeds, and whatsoever comes into being by nature dies, disintegrates. Now, in this process of coming into being, growing, and passing away, as we call it, there is perpetual change. But how does that change take place? It takes place from infinitesimal fragment of a second to the next infinitesimal fragment of a second. Now consider, in what manner are we conscious of change? In terms of big chunks of time, we are quite unable to respond consciously to the change in that infinitesimal fraction of a second. We are unable to do it. That is why I like to present life and death as practically simultaneous. And I always call death in actuality other life. Because in this changing process, what is implied? That which is in this millionth of a second has ceased to exist and emerged into the next millionth of a second. This is the nature of, at least the manifested nature of eternal life. Is it not? Now, if I can be completely in tune, at least, in rhythm with this infinitesimal second, fraction of a second, and with that change which takes place, I do not draw any line between life and death. It is life, other life. The pulse of creation is an extraordinary thing. It is not merely construction and destruction. Construction and destruction become a one thing. You know, you can experience this in sometimes, provided it is granted unto you. But this is the grace of the transcendent. All these things are granted. They are all free. There they are. We don't pay for space, for light. We don't pay for life. We don't know the meaning of life. But there we are. Now, if one is conscious thus, one is actually experiencing non-mortality. Our concept of mortality is this fellow is alive here and now at this moment. He comes to what we call the end of his life. He takes a last breath and this becomes a corpse. And it totally disintegrates. But consider this disintegration. It is not annihilation. This is the important thing. You know how fond I am of quoting Shakespeare's "But doth undergo a sea change into something rich and strange." Ariel talks of Ferdinand's father and the storm. What has happened to his father? Of his bones are coral made, those are pearls that were his eyes, and so forth. His being undergoes but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Associate that with Sri Krishna's statement in the Gita when he reveals himself to Arjuna. Being and non-being and I. Death and the origin of all things am I. It was those two statements of Sri Krishna which about 15 years ago or so or more suddenly gave me the flash. Being and non-being am I. Non-being is not some annihilation at all. Similarly, death is not death as we understand it at all. It's transformation. Only I'm unconscious of it. This, the limited finite being, is restored into the one infinite, eternal non-being. And that non-being expressing by self-constriction, expressing itself, produces innumerable beings, the one and the many. But do not think that when I, the being, am restored or transformed, not restored, transformed into the non-being, that I as an entity persist. That is why, I'm sorry, but it's a terrible thing to say, there is nothing for me whatsoever in a mythical hereafter. There is no persistence of entity, no persistence particularly of the I am I consciousness. This I am I consciousness comes into being only after birth. Even in sleep, in deep slumber, where is your I am I consciousness? If mere deep slumber can do that, what does the disintegration of the living organism do? But if you really love, care for the truth, it will terrify you at first. It will sear your soul. But let it happen. until your number is up, you won't be killed. Now you see, if you will just be quiet, not withstand, not retreat, not turn your face away from the light or towards the dark. Just let be and see what happens. This fear of death which we have, which is always accompanied by this tremendous clinging to one's life, one's separate life, remember, all that vanishes. And if that vanishes, how many ill things vanish with it? And then this vile body is truly the indispensable instrument of liberation and realization. Read the Atharva Veda. I think I can quickly. It is the 8th hymn in Book 11 of the Atharva Veda, and it is concerned with the origin of the gods, as we call them, and of man. Questions are asked. Who brought together hair, sinews, bones, marrow, flesh, etc., etc.? And the answer comes in these terms. Gods made the mortal their abode and entered and possessed the man. Now the word gods in this context doesn't mean gentlemen upstairs, some of them with consorts, others without, you see, and so forth. It doesn't mean that. The word gods just stands for the archetypal energies on the cosmic scale, the operation of which energies produces the whole of manifestation. It's as simple as that. And the hymn ends, then the gods, all the gods entered into man. All waters, all the deities, Viraj with Brahma at her side, Brahma into the body passed. Prajapati is lord thereof, and so on. And the last verse, therefore, whoever knoweth man regardeth him as Brahman's self. Now you will appreciate why I have used that phrase. Man is transcendence embodied.